Okay, so today we're going to dive into something that I think is pretty timely.
Yeah.
You know, we hear a lot about these days bringing back manufacturing and protecting domestic industries and all of that. And we're going to take a deep dive into what that really means.
Yeah, and I think this is an area that's so politically charged right now. You know, you've got folks on both sides of the aisle, really, making some pretty big claims about what the impact of, you know, tariffs and you know, all these other policies are going to be.
Right.
And it can be hard to kind of cut through the noise and figure out, okay, what's the real story here? What are the actual consequences of these kinds of policies?
And that's what we're hoping to do today. We're going to be looking specifically in a paper called Manufacturing and Economy by Jeff Bernard.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting about this paper is that he takes a historical look at the real consequences of these policies.
Yeah, he does a deep dive into the experiences of some major manufacturing nations. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's not just about theory. It's about looking at how these things actually played out on the ground. And, you know, the countries that he really focuses on are Japan and Germany, both, you know, countries that have historically been, you know, manufacturing powerhouses and looking at how their experiences with trade barriers and you know, kind of this focus on protecting domestic industries has actually impacted their economies.
So our mission for this deep dive, I guess you could say, is to really understand what has happened, what Bernard's research shows us, and maybe get some insights into what that means for us today.
Yeah. Are we making the same mistakes? Are we headed down a path that, you know, others have already kind of explored and maybe found to be not so beneficial in the long run?
Let's start with Japan. I think most people listening probably remember Japan as this like manufacturing giant, right?
Absolutely. The cars, yeah. Okay. The electronics, you know, the quality and the precision. It was really kind of a symbol of, you know, industrial might.
Right. And yet Bernard's argument is that Japan has experienced this prolonged period of economic stagnation. And he traces that back to an overemphasis on manufacturing and specifically on protecting that sector.
Yeah. And that's the irony, right? It's like the very thing that made them so successful in the early years, in a way, became a bit of a trap later on.
So how did those policies that were intended to nurture and protect Japanese manufacturing end up contributing to their struggles?
Well, it's a complex story, but, you know, one of the things that Bernard really emphasizes is this idea of a lack of diversification.
Lack of diversification meaning?
They put so much of their eggs in the manufacturing basket, particularly in areas like automobiles and electronics.
Right.
And as the global economy changed, as taste shifted, as new technologies emerged,
they were kind of stuck.
They were stuck. They were vulnerable. They didn't have this, you know, broad base of other industries to kind of cushion the blow if those specific sectors started to struggle.
And then on top of that, you have what Bernard calls Japan's demographic challenges, which everyone's heard about, right? An aging and shrinking population.
Yeah. And that's a huge issue when you're so reliant on manufacturing, because manufacturing tends to be labor intensive.
You need people to actually build the things.
Right. And if you have fewer young people coming into the workforce and you know, an aging population, it becomes harder to sustain that level of production.
Right.
And Japan's historically restrictive immigration policies just kind of compounded the problem.
They weren't really bringing in workers from elsewhere to fill those gaps.
Exactly. So you have this kind of internal workforce issue, and then you have this external issue of diminishing global competitiveness.
Because other countries were catching up, right?
Exactly. You know, you see the rise of countries like South Korea and later on China, you know, coming in with often significantly lower labor costs.
And they could just produce things cheaper.
Right. And that put a lot of pressure on Japanese manufacturers who are used to kind of being at the top of the game.
So they were losing market share.
They were losing market share, their exports were declining, and it really kind of put a squeeze on their economy.
Now, one of the things that Bernard also talks about is Japan's over-reliance on subsidies and government intervention, particularly in the years after World War II.
Yeah, and this is really interesting because those policies initially were credited with, you know, Japan's remarkable recovery after the war.
Everyone talks about the Japanese economic miracle.
Exactly. But Bernard argues that over time, this dependence on government support actually created a situation of what he calls resource misallocation.
Meaning?
That instead of capital flowing naturally to the most efficient and innovative industries, it was being directed by the government to, you know, prop up these specific manufacturing sectors.
It's almost like it created an artificial support system.
Yeah, it did. It kind of distorted the market and reduced the incentives for companies to become truly competitive on their own.
Right, because they knew the government would always be there to kind of bail them out or to support them.
Exactly. And that kind of leads into his next point about protection from global competition.
Right, the tariffs and the import restrictions, all of that.
Yeah, because in the short term, those measures can certainly shield domestic industries from foreign rivals, but in the long term, they also shield them from the very pressures that drive innovation and efficiency.
You don't have to be as good if you're not facing that competition.
Right. If you're not constantly having to, you know, improve your products and your processes to stay ahead of the game, you tend to become complacent.
And that ultimately hurts you.
It hurts you in the long run because you're not keeping up with the rest of the world.
So you're not as nimble. You're not as adaptable.
Exactly. And that's something that Japan really struggled with.
Now, he also talks about this concept of structural rigidities and the impact on innovation.
Yeah.
And specifically, he mentions the Keiretsu and this idea of Japan Inc. Can you explain what those are?
So Keiretsu are these really interesting structures that are kind of unique to Japan. They're these tightly knit networks of companies that are often interconnected through cross shareholdings.
So they're all kind of invested in each other.
Right. And they have these close business relationships, and it often revolves around a major bank at the center.
Okay.
And Japan Inc. refers to this broader culture of close cooperation between the government and these big industrial groups.
So it's like this very cozy kind of system.
It is. It's very cozy, and it can be very good for stability and, you know, long-term planning, but it can also stifle innovation.
Because it's not as open to new ideas or to new players coming in.
Right. It tends to prioritize the established players and the existing ways of doing things over, you know, embracing radical new ideas or letting, you know, startups or disruptive companies come in and shake things up.
So you have this kind of lack of external competition because of the protectionist policies.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have this lack of internal competition because of the way the Keiretsu system works.
Exactly. And that's what Bernard calls a lack of competitive discipline.
And that lack of discipline ultimately kind of dragged Japan down.
It did, because it reduced the incentives to innovate, to improve efficiency, and to adapt to the changing global landscape.
And then he also briefly touches upon the bubble economy and its aftermath in Japan.
Yeah, that was this really fascinating period in the late 1980s where you had this, you know, incredible run-up in asset prices. You know, stock market, real estate, everything was going through the roof.
Everyone thought Japan was going to take over the world.
They did, but it turned out to be a bubble, and it burst spectacularly. And Bernard suggests that government policies played a role in inflating that bubble.
So it's almost like they were trying to stimulate growth, and they ended up creating this unsustainable situation.
Right. And when the bubble burst, it exposed the underlying weaknesses of an economy that had become kind of addicted to intervention and protectionism.
So it was a really painful period for Japan.
Right.
And it kind of reinforced this idea that maybe this model wasn't so sustainable in the long run.
Exactly. And it took them a long time to kind of recover from that. And Bernard argues that part of the problem was a reluctance to really embrace structural reforms.
So they were kind of clinging to the old ways, even though it wasn't really working anymore.
Right. And that's a real danger, I think, when you get too invested in a particular model. You become resistant to change, even when change is necessary.
So I think Japan's experience, as Bernard describes it, is a really cautionary tale.
It is. It shows the dangers of overemphasizing manufacturing, of relying too heavily on protectionism, and of becoming too resistant to change.
And it's a reminder that what might work in one period might not work in another.
Exactly. You have to be adaptable. You have to be willing to evolve as the global economy changes.
All right. Well, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about Germany, another country that's well known for its manufacturing prowess.
Yeah, Germany is really interesting because they have this incredibly strong manufacturing sector, you know, especially in areas like automobiles and machinery.
It's quality, the engineering, it's all top notch.
Absolutely. But Bernard argues that this very strength also creates certain vulnerabilities.
So it's almost like a double-edged sword.
In a way, it is. You know, one of the things he points to is the high labor and energy costs in Germany.
Right. Germany is not exactly known for being a low-cost producer.
It's not. And that makes it harder for them to compete with manufacturers in other parts of the world where those costs are significantly lower.
Like China, for example.
Like China, exactly. So, yeah. You know, as a result, you've seen some of the more cost-sensitive manufacturing industries decline in Germany.
Right. They're moving to where it's cheaper to produce.
Exactly. And Germany has had to focus more on, you know, specialized high-value added manufacturing to kind of stay ahead of the curve.
Okay. So that's one challenge, the cost factor. But he also talks about Germany's vulnerability to supply chain disruptions.
Yeah, and this is something that really came to the forefront during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Everything got so messed up.
It did, because you suddenly realized how interconnected the global economy is and how reliant we are on these complex supply chains.
Right, and Germany, with its export-dependent manufacturing model, was particularly exposed.
Because they're bringing in components and materials from all over the world, and if those flows get disrupted, it can really throw a wrench in the work.
It could bring everything to a halt.
It can, and that's exactly what happened to some extent. You know, during the pandemic, you saw factories shutting down because they couldn't get the parts they needed.
Right, so that's a real vulnerability for Germany. And it's something that they're trying to address by diversifying their supply chains and becoming more resilient.
Exactly. They're realizing that they can't put all their eggs in one basket. They need to have backup plans and alternative sources.
Okay. And then the other point that Bernard makes about Germany is this idea of sluggish innovation outside of manufacturing.
Yeah, this is interesting because while Germany is a leader in manufacturing innovation, you know, they're constantly improving their production processes and the quality of their goods.
They're always pushing the boundaries there.
They are, but Bernard argues that they haven't been as successful in some of the newer, more rapidly evolving sectors like digital technologies or software development.
So they're great at building cars, but maybe not so great at building the software that runs those cars.
That's kind of the idea, and that could potentially hinder their long-term growth because these are the industries that are really driving the global economy now.
And if you're not at the forefront of those industries, you risk falling behind.
Exactly. So Germany is facing a challenge of how to maintain its manufacturing strength while also becoming more competitive in these newer areas.
So it's a balancing act.
It is, and it's a challenge that a lot of developed economies are grappling with.
Now let's talk about China, because Bernard presents their state-led approach to industrial development as kind of a contrasting example.
Yeah, China is a fascinating case study because they've taken a very different path, and it's been incredibly successful in terms of rapid economic growth.
They've become a manufacturing powerhouse.
They have, and one of the key features of their model is the creation of these massive industrial clusters.
These are like whole cities dedicated to manufacturing.
Almost. They're these incredibly concentrated areas where you have factories, warehouses, logistics centers, all kind of integrated together.
And the government has played a very active role in developing these clusters.
Oh, absolutely. They've provided huge subsidies, they've invested heavily in infrastructure, and they've really kind of directed the development of these areas.
And one of the results of that is this really high degree of manufacturing and supply chain integration.
Yeah, because everything is so close together. You know, you can move goods and materials very quickly and efficiently, and it reduces costs and shortens lead times.
So it's a very streamlined system.
It is. And they've also created these things called special economic zones, which are basically areas that offer tax breaks and other incentives to attract foreign investment.
So it's like they're rolling out the red carpet for companies to come in and set up shop.
Exactly. And that's been a really successful strategy in terms of attracting multinational corporations and boosting exports.
Now, Bernard also describes these things called pod cities, which are essentially self-contained urban areas that are designed to support these manufacturing clusters.
Yeah, they're like these mini cities that have everything you need, you know, housing, transportation, shops, restaurants, hospitals, schools.
So it's like they're creating these whole ecosystems around these industrial zones.
Exactly. And it's all designed to make life easier for the workers and to create this very efficient and productive environment.
And one of the key elements of that is the development of residential high-rise communities right next to the factories.
Yeah, they've built these huge apartment complexes that are very affordable, and they're located within walking distance of the factories.
So people don't have to commute long distances.
Right, and that saves time and money, and it also reduces pollution and traffic congestion.
So there are a lot of benefits to this kind of integrated approach.
There are, and it's been very successful in terms of reducing costs and boosting productivity.
But Bernard argues that trying to replicate this model in the U.S. would be very difficult.
Yeah, there are a number of challenges. You know, one is that we have very different urban and regulatory landscapes.
Our cities are not really designed for this kind of high-density development.
They're not. And our zoning laws and land use regulations make it very difficult to create these kind of integrated zones.
Right. We also have a much more market-driven real estate system.
Yeah, so it's not as easy for the government to come in and just dictate where things are going to be built.
And then there are also cultural and political factors to consider.
Absolutely. Americans tend to prefer suburban living and individual home ownership.
It's kind of part of the American dream.
It is. And that's very different from the kind of high density urban lifestyle that you see in China's industrial clusters.
They're trying to impose that kind of model on the U.S., would probably face a lot of resistance.
It would. And then there's also the issue of economic efficiency versus market dynamics.
Right, because China's model relies heavily on state-controlled subsidies
right.
and directed investment.
Yeah, and that's very different from the U.S.'s more free market approach.
So it's not clear that those same cost reductions and efficiencies could be achieved in the U.S. without a lot of government intervention.
And Bernard argues that that kind of intervention could actually stifle innovation and flexibility, which are two of the U.S.'s biggest strengths.
It's a trade-off.
It is. And it's not clear that the Chinese model is really the right fit for the U.S.
So it's a fascinating model to study, but not necessarily one that we can just copy and paste.
Exactly. And I think that brings us back to Bernard's central argument about the fallacy of manufacturing primacy.
This idea that a strong economy must be built on a dominant manufacturing sector.
Right. And he argues that that's just not true anymore, particularly for developed economies.
The world has changed.
It has. And trying to force a return to that model through trade barriers and other interventions is likely to do more harm than good.
And he sees the experiences of Japan and Germany as cautionary tales in that regard.
They show the dangers of clinging too tightly to manufacturing and of trying to protect it at all costs.
And he even uses this economic concept of Pareto efficiency to explain why that's problematic.
Yeah, Pareto efficiency basically means that you can't make one person or one group better off without making someone else worse off.
So it's like a zero-sum game.
In a way it is, and Bernard argues that protectionist policies violate this principle.
Because they might benefit domestic manufacturers, but they hurt consumers and other businesses.
Exactly. They raise prices, they reduce competition, and they stifle innovation.
So it's not a win-win situation.
It's not. And in the long run, it's likely to make the economy as a whole worse off.
So what does Bernard recommend that the U.S. should be doing instead of trying to bring back manufacturing?
He says that we should focus on our strengths, which are in high-value added industries like technology, finance, and professional services.
Those are the areas where we have a competitive advantage.
They are, and they're also the areas that are driving economic growth and creating high-paying jobs.
So we should be investing in those areas and trying to make them even stronger.
Exactly. And he's very critical of current U.S. policies that are aimed at bringing back large-scale manufacturing through protectionism.
He thinks it's not feasible and it's likely to cause a lot of damage.
He does. He thinks it's based on a flawed understanding of how the global economy works, and it's likely to lead to a lot of unintended consequences.
So he's basically saying that we need to adapt to the new reality.
We do. We can't try to recreate the past. We need to focus on the future and on the industries that are going to be driving growth in the 21st century.
Well, this has been a really fascinating deep dive into Jeff Bernard's analysis of the complex relationship between trade barriers and economic outcomes.
It has, and I think it's given us a lot to think about.
It has. And it's a reminder that there are no easy answers when it comes to economics.
Absolutely. It's a complex and ever-changing landscape, and we need to be careful about making decisions that might seem beneficial in the short term, but could have negative consequences in the long run.
So as we wrap up here, I want to leave our listeners with a question to ponder.
Okay.
Given all that we've discussed about the different paths that countries like Japan, Germany, and China have taken, the challenges they faced, what does true economic resilience look like for a country like the U.S. in the 21st century?
It's a big question.
It is, and there's no single answer, but I think it's something that we all need to be thinking about as we navigate this increasingly complex and interconnected global economy.
I agree, and I think Bernard's analysis gives us some valuable insights into the potential pitfalls of certain policies and the importance of adaptability and innovation.
So as we move forward, we need to be mindful of those lessons and make sure that we're making decisions that are going to benefit the U.S. economy in the long run.
Absolutely. And that's going to require a lot of careful thought and a willingness to adapt to the changing realities of the global marketplace.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you for joining us for this deep dive into Jeff Bernard's Manufacturing and Economy.
It's been a pleasure.
And I encourage our listeners to check out the paper for themselves and to continue exploring these really important issues.
Absolutely. There's a lot more to learn, and we need to keep the conversation going.
Thanks for listening.